I was talking in my brief introduction on the nature of networking and how I'm so in favor of that and how I so enjoy it. And what have I got today? I am introducing Lord Justice Tolson. I mean, how good is that, hey? What do I know about judges? Well, I know about Rumpole of the Bailey. I know how grumpy and irascible they are. I spent this morning chatting with Roger. I was putting to Roger these impossible questions. Tell me, Roger, what is the nature of truth? How do you judge truth? And all the rest. And bless him, he was responding and speaking to me. And he then apologized and said, Martin, I'm so terribly sorry. I know what you want is a black and white answer, and I'm giving these grey, gentle replies. And I'm so relieved it wasn't a black and white. This is a compassionate man. He is here, and I feel safe in his hands as one of our judges of this nation. So I have no more to say other than I welcome you, Roger, and look forward to your talk.
Well, thank you very much. Nothing like building up expectations. But it is really good to be here and a fascinating conference. Can I just kick off by saying that what I'm going to talk about is the law of England and Wales. I only mention that because in Glasgow they have a different system of criminal law, and I don't really know, broadly it's similar, but it's not identical. Now, most criminal offences comprise a physical element and a mental element, both of which the prosecution have to prove. Lawyers, from long-standing habit, refer to these as the actus reus, or guilty act, and mens rea, or guilty mind. And we've long since, incidentally, gone past the days in the Peter Cook and Dudley Moore sketch where one man in somewhat dishevelled clothing on the park bench explains to the other that he was to be a High Court judge, but he failed his Latin exam. We don't have to take Latin exams anymore, but some of these phrases are part of the vocabulary, and they're still used, and they were used this morning. I listened not long ago to a talk on a discussion on the on Radio 4 about proposals for the law of reform of the law of murder, in which I'm very interested, and a senior police officer, either from the ACPO, Chief Constables Organisation, or Police Federation, I forget which, was talking about the whole thing in terms of mens rea. And I thought, well, it's not just lawyers who use it. I wonder what the listener shaving is making of all that. You might think that the questions of responsibility, mental responsibility, would fall entirely under the heading of mens rea issues, and the law could have developed in that way. But in fact, it hasn't. Questions of mental responsibility for the defendant's muscular activity can be relevant also to whether the conduct element of the offence has been proved, the actus reus. So I'm going to need to try to summarise how the law has developed in relation to both these essential components of criminal liability. And we'll start with the conduct element, or actus reus. Now, this is usually defined in terms of some positive act, but it may sometimes consist of an omission. The owner of a car which has been caught on camera going over the speed limit can be required to say whether he was the driver, or if not, who was, and his or her omission to provide that information will be a criminal offence. And in the field of health and safety, there are many statute requirements which compel an employer or an occupier of premises which are open to the public to take positive steps for the protection of employees or other people. But most criminal offences, and particularly more serious offences, do involve committing a prohibited act. That's not a universal rule. I mean, willful neglect to maintain a child is a very serious offence, and that can be committed by pure omission. Manslaughter can be committed by omission to meet the needs of a child or vulnerable relative if the omission is of sufficiently grave culpability. But if you look across the broad range of serious crimes, murder, terrorism, rape and other sexual offences, robbery and other crimes of violence, burglary and so on, these all involve positive acts. So what does that mean? It would have been possible for the law to treat any form of muscular activity as an act sufficient for the purposes of constituting the actus reus. But the law does not. The muscular activity has to involve volition for it to be treated as the defendant's act. Take a simple example. If I'm standing in a crowded bar with a glass and somebody jogs my elbow accidentally or deliberately and the glass goes into somebody's face or body and causes them an injury, that is not treated by the law as my act because it's completely involuntary on my part. So one then comes to the difficult question, how does the law draw a line between voluntary and involuntary activity when it's looking at the actus reus element of the offence? Now, this area of the law is almost entirely judge-made. It's been built up by rulings in a series of cases. And where the courts have drawn the line is really very much a matter of policy. Underlying it has been the court's feel for what is fair in a particular case. The courts have never attempted a kind of universal scientific formulation that meets every situation. The case law does show that the types of case where the law treats the conduct as not amounting to an act of the defendant as narrow. We looked at one type of case where the defendant's muscular activity was brought about by the act of a third party, which the defendant was incapable of doing anything about. And the same would apply in the case that Chris in his first lecture instanced of the sudden attack by the swarm of bees. This is a supervening external event, and the reaction of the defendant is purely, if you like, reflex. It's not something which is the product in any sense of his or her volition. Another category is where the defendant is disabled by some sudden disability of an internal kind, such as a stroke or a heart attack. If a motorist has a sudden heart attack or stroke and goes through a red light, he won't be guilty of committing an offence because he won't be regarded as actually having been driving. It wasn't actually his. There was no element of volition in what he did. He had been completely disabled by the stroke or the heart attack. Well, then one gets to the slightly trickier area about, well, what about the driver who falls asleep at the wheel, or the driver who's diabetic and suffers onset of loss of consciousness through his illness? could he have taken avoiding action earlier? And that's come before the courts, and the pragmatic solution which they have come up with is to say that if the defendant could and should have foreseen the situation, then they are culpable, not because they were actually conscious at the moment of the accident, but because they can't say the result was entirely beyond my volition, because they had actually made a choice to continue to drive at a time when they were becoming drowsy or knowing that they had failed to take their medication. And the case that Chris instanced of the driver who had slept properly, woke up in the morning, went driving, phoned his wife to give her the wake-up call, and then 2 minutes later, completely unexpectedly, had a loss of consciousness, was acquitted, and whether that was Scots law or English law, we would have the same result. It would be different if this condition had been diagnosed in advance, and the doctor had said to him, you know, you could have a sudden onset when you're behind the wheel and you shouldn't be driving. Then we have the category of the person who is acting in some sort of state of intoxication or hallucination. The person who's taken a mind-changing substance, LSD, and then acts under the hallucinatory effects of that and may be completely unconscious of what they're doing or think that they're doing something utterly different from that which they have. The court's approach to the question of actus reus in that type of case is to take a strict view against somebody who has voluntarily exposed himself or herself to that risk. So if you choose to get drunk or take hallucinatory drugs, you cannot say that what you then did in that state was entirely without your volition. It may not have had your volition at the moment, but it had your volition because you had knowingly courted the risk. The sleepwalker. Well, the courts, as you've already heard, have coined the word automatism for a person who does physical movements, and it may be a whole sequence of physical movements which would appear to be directed, not just random, e.g. the person who gets out of bed, finds the car keys, goes downstairs, unbolts the door, opens the car, gets into it, switches on the ignition, drives off, and then has an accident, but is wholly unconscious of what he is doing, because he is in the state described to you earlier. And that would be classified by the law as a case of automatism, that he's acting in a robotic fashion. And as you've also heard, the approach of the court has been to divide automatism cases into two subcategories, so-called sane automatism and insane automatism. Sane automatism would include the sleepwalking type of case where the court would say that was not the person's act. It lacked the necessary element of volition and therefore he's not guilty. In cases where the automatism is a product of a diseased state of mind, e.g. the person who suffers from a psychotic illness, then the approach the courts have taken is to say that he or she can rely only on the defences which the law provides for mentally disordered people. There, the insanity provides a defence, but the result of a finding of insanity by the jury is not
a simple acquittal. It is a finding of not guilty by reason of insanity, and the consequence is that the court can then make a hospital order which involves no element of finding of guilt, but does provide protection for the individual and the public. And the reason why the courts have divided automatism into sane and insane is simply this, that they've seen that a body of law has been developed to deal with the type of psychotic instance that I've mentioned, which is both humane but properly takes account of the needs of society and the public. And the courts were pretty horrified at the idea that somebody who was a danger to himself and others because of a psychotic illness could actually say, well, through the route of automatism, I avoid a finding of not guilty by reason of insanity with the hospital order regime available in that situation, but can say that I'm actually not guilty altogether and therefore free to go out and do the same thing the next day to somebody else. Now, this is why I say that the law has developed in a way which is policy-driven in the individual types of case. Hypnosis. We're going to have a talk this afternoon about this, which should be fascinating. I deeply regret the fact I'm not going to be able to stay for it. I would particularly like to do so because Professor Graham Wagstaff gave evidence about this in a case that, curious enough, I happened to try a few years ago. It was a personal injury claim brought against a well-known television hypnotist, Paul McKenna. And she, the claimant, said that as a result of what had happened to her under hypnosis from him, she had developed a severe illness. And she was bolstered in her case by a large amount of literature which Paul McKenna had published, making very great claims for what hypnosis can do to you. There was a certain irony to the case that his defense was amounted to saying, actually, hypnosis doesn't have any of those effects at all. It's purely a matter of auto-suggestion. I found it an absolutely fascinating case. And I say this not only because Graham is here, but I found his evidence utterly compelling, along also with that of the psychiatrist on the subject of causes of schizophrenia. And I said so in my judgment. One of the great joys about being a judge is you're a bit of a butterfly. You sort of flit from area to area, having a look at the science on this subject and science on that subject. You say, oh, that's quite interesting. And you go back and you say to your wife, I've had interesting, I read all about this. And I was absolutely fascinated by the literature I read in that case. Some wonderful experiments. For example, I particularly remember one where literature showed that a group of students had been divided into three, and one lot were told that they were going to have a wonderful evening because they were going to have unlimited quantities of high-strength lager. The next lot were told that they were going to have unlimited quantities of sort of medium strength. And the third lot said, well, bad luck, you're going to be given unlimited quantities of a brew which has almost no alcohol in it at all, but it tastes quite nice. And so they all drank away. But they were actually given the opposite of what they were told. And an hour later, the ones who'd actually been drinking stuff which had 0.001% alcohol were absolutely high as kites. And the ones they'd been told they were on high strength, but they'd actually it was minimal alcohol. The ones who'd been told that they were on minimal alcohol, but had actually got the high strength stuff, were very gloomy, mournful, and were saying, why couldn't we have some proper beer? I mean, I found that and other pieces of evidence absolutely fascinating. And as I say, it's a most interesting life as a job because you look into the products of other people's research
But where does all that lead us in the present context? Well, with one qualification, I would hazard the following guess, and I say it's a guess because I'm not actually aware of any case law which deals the question of criminal liability for an act done by somebody when they claim to have been acting in a trance produced by hypnosis. So I am suggesting what I think would be the answer in those cases. And I think that the ordinary, the default position would be this, that they would indeed be not guilty because what they did was done in a state in which they were exercising no conscious control of their over their movements. They may have been subconsciously driven, but they didn't have that degree of conscious control necessary to constitute the volition element of a criminal act. But I would qualify that, because what about the person who puts himself in that state with awareness of the risks that may entail? Or let's take an extreme case, somebody who is asked to carry out a nasty crime, and he says, well, I'd be a bit scared of doing that. I think I'd bottle out at the last minute, or I'd probably be very nervous and make a bosh of it. And the inciter says, well, that's all right, well, we can cope for that, because I've got a very good friend who's a hypnotist, and he'll put you into complete trance, and then I'll tell you exactly what you do, and you do it, and it'll all, you know, it'll be a dream. A dream for you in more senses than one. Well, now, I'm pretty confident that if the facts came out that way, the court would not accept that the person who had acted in a hypnotic trance induced in order that he should be able to carry out the offence could claim that it was done without his volition. And indeed, there have been cases where people who've drunk in order to give themselves Dutch courage to commit a crime have been held not to be entitled in any way to rely on that as a defence. But broadly speaking, that an act which is done by a person, or when I say an act that's done, that begs the question, but activities which would appear to have been performed by somebody in a state of unconsciousness, coma or sleep, would be regarded by the law as not their act at all, with the caveat that if they had put themselves in that situation of risk by their own irresponsible activity, then they would not be entitled to plead lack of the necessary volition. Then we move to the mental element, the mens rea. Now, the mental requirement of a crime varies from crime to crime. As I've already mentioned, there are some offences of so-called strict liability which do not require mental intent at all. For example, going through a red light, you may not intend to do so. You may be busy on the mobile or seeing that girl who's walking along the street, and, oh, my God, that was a red light. The fact you didn't actually intend to go through the red light would be no defence at all. It is an offence of so-called strict liability. But most offences require some form of mental intent. And here things get a little complicated because, for reasons which I'll mention, courts have introduced another classification. They divide, for some purposes, crimes of intent to ones of basic intent and specific intent. A crime of basic intent is where the only mental element required is actually an intent to do the act. But a crime will be one of specific intent if there is some additional mental element required.
What on earth am I talking about? Well, perhaps I can best answer that by giving a simple illustration. The crime of wounding with intent to cause grievous bodily harm is a more serious offence than the crime of simple unlawful wounding, because unlawful wounding requires an intent to do what the defendant has done. If my slashing somebody with a knife was entirely accidental, I was actually trying to peel my banana, and it was purely a slip which caused it to go into somebody else's heart, well, then I'm not guilty of wounding, because I had no intent to do the act at all. All I was intending to do was peel a banana. But if wounding with intent, that's a crime of basic intent. Wounding with intent is a crime of specific intent, because the prosecution has to prove not only that the wounding was intentional, but that it was done with the intention of causing really serious harm. Why have the courts got themselves into that complication, which you might think is interesting but unnecessary? Well, it's really to deal with cases such as the drunk, who then commits an offence while drunk. And the line that the law has drawn is to say that drunkenness, self-induced drunkenness, can provide no defence to a crime of basic intent. If you do an act which appears to be a deliberate act, and your only reason for doing it is because you have put yourself in an intoxicated state, that does not provide a defence. And again, one can see the social reason behind that. Courts don't want people to be able to get absolutely out of their minds every Saturday night and say, whoops, I'm awfully sorry, but you know, it was the drink what done it, not me. On the other hand, it may be a matter of fact that they did not have the additional specific intent required to be guilty of a particular offence, and the courts have said that, therefore, although a drunken intent can still be an intent, if their state of intoxication was such that they didn't have the additional intent to make them guilty of a crime of specific intent, then they would have a valid defence to that additionally aggravated form of offence. I should stress that volition, which I was talking about in terms of whether the actus reus element is established, whether what the defendant, in inverted commas, did is to be regarded as his act at all, is not the same as whether it was intentional. In this sense, the courts don't regard volition and intent as quite the same. Now, I sense we may be getting into what may seem rather confused waters here, so let me just try and give a simple example which I think will make sense of it. There used to be a curious maxim in the criminal law that somebody was presumed to intend the natural consequences of his act. And as one wise jurist pointed out, to say that they are presumed to intend it belies ordinary experience. If a gopher drives from the tee and slices the ball firmly into the rough, only a judge could possibly say that he was presumed to intend to drive into the rough. The act was volitional. I mean, you couldn't say that his driving of the golf ball wasn't a voluntary act. It was his act, all right. There wasn't somebody else behind him who grabbed hold of his arms and swung his club for him. It was volitional, but he didn't intend to plant the ball in the rough. So that is where one has to keep separate whether the defendant can legitimately say, I lack enough control over what I was doing for this to be regarded as a volitional act at all, and whether I had the intent to make me guilty of this offence. And actually, that distinction is beautifully illustrated by the case that Chris instanced this morning of the person who, in an abnormal state, gets up from his bed, goes out, drives his car and crashes it, and then subsequently comes back, rings the police and says, most unfortunately, somebody has nicked my car, and is charged with attempting to pervert the course of justice. Now, if you asked the English lawyer whether he was guilty of, firstly, careless or dangerous driving, and secondly, of attempting to pervert the course of justice, if we assume that what the person was saying was truthful, the English lawyer would say that he was not guilty on either count, but for quite different reasons. He'd been not guilty of the offence of careless driving, even though that doesn't require any mental intent at all. It's no defence to a charge of careless driving that you didn't mean to be careless. But he wouldn't be guilty of a careless driving offence because it would not be regarded as an act of his volition if his story about acting in the disturbed state Chris described was true. By the time he came to report it to the police, he was compos mentis and knew what he was doing. So there'd be no question of automatism providing a defence to that charge, but the prosecution would have to prove that he intended to pervert the course of justice. And because he didn't actually have that intent, he wouldn't be guilty. All pretty clear, really, isn't it? I would like to say just a little about diminished responsibility and children. These are special parts of the law. Which don't really form part of the general description that I've been trying to give you. The position in relation to children is, frankly, I think, troublesome. We have 10 as our age of criminal responsibility, which is really very low by most European standards. There used to be a doctrine called dolox incapi, incapable of doing, dolly incapi, dolly incapax, that's right, incapable of doing wrong. And in the case of a child or a young person, the prosecution had to prove that they had reached the stage of development to understand that they were doing wrong to have sufficient criminal responsibility for their actions. And that got abolished some years ago. So any child of 10 upwards is treated as having full adult responsibility for their acts. I think many of us find that quite troubling. But attempts by the Royal Society of Psychiatrists to push reform of the law have failed, and I don't think it's on the political horizon at the moment. What happens in practice is that generally the Crown Prosecution Service will only prosecute for really serious offences, and they get dealt with in special ways procedurally. But it's a big area. It merits a lecture on its own, and I think it's, for my own part, still a somewhat troublesome area. I mean, nobody, I think, would want to have a situation where the court said that a a 12-year-old, 13-year-old can go around raping schoolmates, as sadly is happening, and go scot-free. But whether we've actually got the right way of dealing with that sort of situation is a very different matter. The other matter I just want to touch on very shortly is diminished responsibility in the law of murder. Normally, the law is not concerned in determining guilt or innocence with questions of degree of responsibility. That may be very relevant when it comes to the sentencing stage, what the court should do. But in determining guilt or innocence, the question is, has the prosecution proved that the defendant committed the conduct element of the offence, i.e. was there the necessary degree of volition, yes or no? If there was, have the prosecution showed that there was the necessary mens rea, yes or no? Questions that were of degrees of responsibility are matters of mitigation which come into the equation at the sentencing stage. But we do have an exception in the law of murder. And this goes back to the Homicide Act of 1957, which followed from the report of the Royal Commission on Capital Punishment, which sat for, I think, 3 years in the early 1950s, chaired by Gowers, and produced a highly impressive report. At that stage, the Commission decided not to recommend the abolition of the death penalty, and indeed the death penalty remained for a number of years after that. But the Commission was deeply troubled by the fact that the legal definition of insanity is very narrowly drawn, and that a person might be sentenced to death whose mental state was very far from being normal, although it didn't come within the strict legal definition of insanity. And to fix that particular problem, they recommended the importation from Scots law of a new form of partial defence, which would reduce what would otherwise be murder to the lesser offence of manslaughter, whereas murder carried a mandatory sentence, which in those days was the death penalty. For manslaughter, the death penalty was not available, and the sentence would be at the discretion of the court. So diminished responsibility was introduced to cater for the cases of people who weren't legally insane, but whose state of mind was such as to impair substantially their responsibility for what they did. The legal definition was one which exercised both doctors and lawyers at the time, because it didn't really fall into line with any particular medical classification. But we have it still. It's just been revised in a recent act, which followed on from a report by the Law Commission. I was privileged to be chairman of that body for 4 years, during which we carried out a root and branch review of the law of murder. We concluded that it was a mess and needed radical reform. We thought that the law of diminished responsibility, however difficulty its theoretical underpinnings, had in practice proved to serve a useful purpose, but it needed a certain amount of tidying. And we recommended trying to bring the definition of what could amount to an abnormality of mind sufficient to trigger diminished responsibility into terms that are more easily recognized by forensic psychiatrists. And we also proposed
that in the case of a child or young person, they should be entitled to advanced developmental immaturity as a basis for a potential finding of diminished responsibility. We weren't suggesting that it should automatically provide such a defence, but that it should at least be a matter which a jury could properly take into account. I regret that the government accepted the proposals for reform which we put forward, but omitted the bit about development immaturity of children, because they thought that that could have dangerous consequences. I find that, frankly, baffling, and let me give two reasons. My understanding is that psychiatrists will not make a diagnosis of psychopathy in the case of a child or young person, because they will say it's premature to do so. You may therefore have a child who, or young person, who if they were 3 or 4 years older, would have been diagnosed as a psychopath, a well-known basis for a finding of diminished responsibility, but who aren't because they're younger, but at the same time can't put forward their development immaturity as a defence. And it seems to me to be both bizarre and unjust that a child should, at least in terms of the law, be placed at a disadvantage in that way. Secondly, I find it bizarre and unjust that whereas the law does enable somebody in their 20s to be able to put forward that they had the mental state of a 12-year-old, it appears not to be able to be argued on behalf of a 12-year-old that he has the mental state of a 12-year-old. Now, I hope that in practice my fears will be allayed by the way in which these cases are presented and the way in which jurors respond to them. The bar, the Law Reform Committee originally supported the Law Commission strongly on this, and then they actually abandoned their opposition because I was told they thought, well, a good forensic psychiatrist would be able to present the child's state of mind as falling within an abnormality so as to satisfy the requirements of the Act. In other words, effective what they're saying was that psychiatrists would be able, through the back door, to introduce what they weren't being overtly allowed to introduce through the front door. And that may well be right, that students of the law of murder will see that over the years, juries and judges have in practice shaped the law in order to try to produce just results. But intellectually, I find that area troublesome. It's now 12 o'clock, and that's my cut-off time.
Thank you, Roger, so much.
Absolutely fascinating. This endeavour to try and legislate for human nature is an impossibility, but yourselves take it on. We'd welcome questions now for about a quarter of an hour, and then we'll have a plenary with the two speakers from this morning. Could I ask the questioners, would you wait till you get a microphone? That's the talking stick, essentially. And then we can record this, and of course you can have copies before you leave. Well, not before you leave, but they'll be available. Do you want to come up to this?
No, it's not. Oh, you have to. It's a real sort of pop singer's microphone. You have to hold it very close. Okay. I was very struck by the aside you made that psychopathy can be used as a defence for diminished responsibility, but there's no psychosis involved. The person's in contact with reality. The mens rea and the actus rea are both directly present. Mm. Could you perhaps elaborate on why psychopathy is can be used in that way?
Yes. The easy way for me to answer the question is to take refuge in the facts. The more difficult answer is to try to justify how those facts arrived at. When the Law Commission did its research project on the law of murder and manslaughter, we did analyse cases going back over recent years where there had been findings of diminished responsibility and classify them into their different compartments to see what was the condition in those cases which triggered findings of diminished responsibility. Most of the cases, ones where the verdict of manslaughter was by agreement between the prosecution and the defence, i.e. there wasn't a trial. The defendant was prosecuted for murder. He was examined by psychiatrists on behalf of the prosecution and the defence. All agreed that a finding of not guilty of murder but guilty of manslaughter by reason of diminished responsibility would be appropriate. The judge approved, and so the defendant would plead guilty to manslaughter on that basis and be sentenced accordingly. But in some of them, the finding was by a jury as a result of a contested trial. Overall, curiously, the number of cases where diminished responsibility had been successfully pleaded over recent years had gone down quite remarkably over 20 years. We were puzzled why that should have been. It may be because the law of provocation had seemed to get expanded, and quite often defences would be run which were a mixture of provocation and diminished responsibility. Typically, you know, the battered woman who would rely in part on her mental state and in part on the way in which he'd treated her would run the two in tandem. And because the courts have become more sympathetic over the years, not before time, to the plight of the battered woman in terms of ability to run provocation, it may be that there were fewer cases where it was felt necessary to rely on diminished responsibility. However, all that is a prelude to saying that the figures showed that I think the largest category of cases where there was a finding of diminished responsibility stemmed from a diagnosis of schizophrenia, but there were a significant number where the diagnosis was psychopathy. And that certainly is true to the origins of diminished responsibility, but back in the very early days of the diminished responsibility defence, which followed, as I've said, the 1957 Act, there was a question whether the defence was to be narrowly drawn in the way that you impliedly suggest that clinically it perhaps ought to be drawn. And the then Lord Chief Justice, Lord Parker, in a seminal decision, said that it was really for the jury to take a very broad view whether the defendant was sufficiently different from most normal people that they felt that there was diminished responsibility. This, of course, was at a time when the shadow of the gallows were hanging over defendants. So I think that the sort of theoretical reason lies in a judgment, that judgment of the Court of Appeal, Court of Criminal Appeal, as it then was, encouraging the juries to be able to take a broad view without being too analytical. And since then, psychiatrists making use of that in support of pleas of diminished responsibility. Is that an answer to your question? No.
I mean, psychopaths by their very nature, if we're talking about a particular subset of psychopaths who are very violent, yes, and aggressive, will be part and parcel of a lifestyle that involves attacking others and being very violent, that they are very conscious of, and will sometimes have a quite developed argument about why they should be allowed to do it. For a psychiatrist to come in and say that these are somehow or other mentally abnormal people, you could argue they're just, that's a sort of ethical or moral judgment, that they're just really very nasty people, and that the courts will accept that medicalization of their nastiness to allow diminished responsibility is something I'm curious about.
Well, I see the argument. It would be interesting to have the views of the psychiatrists within the Royal College who specialise on this, e.g. Professor Nigel Eastman, who's written quite a lot and gives evidence in a lot of these cases. I mean, they would, while no doubt respecting your approach, adopt a very different one, and that's one which the courts have allowed over the years.
Yeah. Thank you. Where should we go? Should we go?
Hello.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for that talk. Hello. I have a basic question about the victim that may be involved in an attack, for example.
Yes.
How does the victim judge the way it reacts by the law? If the victim reacts in a kind of violent way, would the law judge the victim?
Do you mean, are you referring to the victim's reaction at the response of the court to the trial of the aggressor?
No, during the attack.
Oh, yes.
Would the victim's reaction be judged later in a court?
If one's looking at the question of the lawfulness of what they did, this does involve the law relating to self-defense. And the law on that is that somebody is entitled to use whatever degree of force is reasonable in order to defend oneself or somebody else against an actual or immediately perceived attack. And that what is reasonable shouldn't be judged minutely by a court analysing months or years afterwards whether what they did was a bit of an overreaction, but should be judged by how it seemed to the victim at the time. And if the victim did no more than the victim genuinely believed was necessary in the circumstances, then they should be acquitted. All that really belongs to the law relating to self-defense. If the victim were found to have overreacted to such a point that they couldn't successfully say that what they did was lawful, then the questions would arise whether actually they had the intent for the offence with which they're charged and whether they, if this point was raised, had the defence of diminished responsibility. There have actually been very few cases in practice, although I think public perception is that there have been many more than there have, where a victim has been brought to court for conduct which he or she has done in response to being attacked or their property broken into. I mean, everybody can talk about the Tony Martin case or the case recently where a couple of people chased after a burglar with a baseball bat and smashed his head in on the street. These are very rare cases, and it has to be remembered in all of those, the question whether the defendant had actually gone so far beyond what was reasonable as to be unlawful is decided by a jury that will be familiar with conditions in the locality. Interestingly, in the Tony Martin case, his conviction for murder was quashed and substituted with a verdict of manslaughter, not on the basis of self-defense, but on the basis of diminished responsibility, which was introduced in the Court of Appeal but hadn't been run at the trial. So the short answer is there aren't special rules which relate to the mental responsibility of victims for what they do. There is the law of self-defense which protects them, and in deciding questions of their mental responsibility, the jury will take into account of all the factual circumstances.
You've got the microphone there, and then, Jackie, if you give the microphone to the lady.
I think a lot of psychologists and neuroscientists and lawyers would agree that the age of criminal responsibility is quite low in this country, like you said. And it varies a lot, but even within Europe, between 10 and 18. How do you think it should be set? And what do you think it should be?
Yeah. Well, that's... political question, and have we got the press here? Yes, I mean,
frankly, we have. Yes,
I mean, I tell you what my honest concern about that is that while I don't mean to be in any way disrespectful to press, and I think it's very helpful for the broad issues that we are discussing to be ventilated, I'm very conscious that a chance remark of one judge on one point, however fairly reported, may get other people to say, top judge, you're always a top judge wherever you are, says, and then other newspapers pick it up. I think all I would therefore want to say is that I think that there is a serious case for raising the age of criminal responsibility, but, and I think it's terribly important that one adds this qualification, because simply to say raise the age of criminal responsibility full stop would be a misdescription of what I think. I think that there plainly must be measures and effective measures to protect society against people who, teenagers and for that matter 12-year-olds, who commit serious acts against others. And the question is whether we have the right legal structure for dealing with that. And if I were looking at this, or had been looking at this at a time when I was at the Law Commission, I'd tell you exactly what we would have done. We would have carried out wide research into this area. We'd have done comparative legal research to see how this is dealt with in other countries which have a higher level, higher age of criminal responsibility. And we would have wanted to take, you know, detailed evidence in this country from people operating in the social services field, from the police, from victims groups, in order that any package of proposals which one came up with were not only intellectually sound, but would have the necessary practical backing to make them work as a package. And I think it would just be over crude to say, I think the age shouldn't be 10, it should be 10 plus X. I think this is a deeply serious question. I mean, part of the problem with our present system, I think, is that with children and young people, you really want to encourage them to accept their responsibility at the earliest possible stage in order that things can move on. But our criminal justice system works in exactly the opposite direction, because the advice given by the lawyer is very likely to be, you know, make no admissions. And I think this is a retrograde system. But I'm not suggesting that there is an easy solution. I do think it needs really detailed study.
Roger, that is such a stunning reply. You know, it's so considered. I mean, that's why you're a top judge. Can we take one more question?
Yes.
And then we'll
Thank
have to...
Thank you for your answer. It's follow on from that, or it was something similar. Because the society is changing and there's lots of antisocial behaviour that's going up and up.
Yes.
And criminal responsibility for children is what I was aiming at.
Yes.
Which you have somewhat answered previously, but yeah. Are we doing anything about it? And the remedial things, are we putting it in place?
Well, there are. Yeah, I mean, there are some very good things being done. There are some work is being done in young offender institutions. Some work is being done outside young offender institutions, which is impressive. There are a number of charities working in this area that are doing deeply impressive work. My knowledge of this is to some extent first-hand from going and visiting some of these places, to some extent second-hand because I happen to be married to a lady who's heavily involved in charity work, including work in prisons. So it is not all bad news. You know, things can be done. But let me just try also to give one slight example by way of answer to your question. One of the things which is deeply troubling to courts and communities is the behaviour of teenage gangs, very often going out armed with knives. Now, some recent study work has been done in Glasgow. Glasgow does seem to feature quite heavily. on why it is that these kids are in gangs. And very often it's because they haven't got a home where they feel part of a unit, they're understood and supported. And gang membership acts as a substitute. It gives them that feeling of being part of a community, cared and valued. It's deeply antisocial in the form that it takes. But this research was saying, now, what we will actually make our society safer if we can get inside the gang mentality, find the youth role models, find ways that we can work with these young people and put them in, employ them constructively. Another example, and I will stop on this one, is some of the work which has been done with musically gifted young offenders. It was a South American country, I'm not sure it's not Venezuela, Brazil, where a lot of this work has been pioneered, and young men, and sometimes kids, come forward and saying, my life was in the gutters, my way of existence was committing crimes, but for these people who had salvaged me, that's what I would be doing. Because of what this organization has done, I've actually now got a purpose in life. You know, it's making music, it's giving me a real sense of value, and this is what we're doing. There is some pioneering work being done in this country. There are a couple of projects of that kind, one in the north. I'm not sure whether it's Julian Lloyd Webber, but one of that family is behind one of them. And I just give that as an instance of some things which can be done at a time when it is possible to turn a child round. Many years ago, I heard a very senior Home Office official who'd been in the prison service for years ask the question, if you were Prime Minister, Lord Chancellor and Home Secretary for the day, what would you do to reduce the rate of crime? And he said, Tell me how long a lifespan I've got for doing it. If I were going for an instant solution, I'd follow the Californian model. I'd bang up everybody who commits a serious offence young, and you would have a situation which you have in California and elsewhere where there are more black people aged 17 to 21 incarcerated than there are in education. He said, if you gave me long term, I would work desperately hard with children at the age of 5, who are coming from families where they're not supported, to enable them to get some structure into their lives and begin to discover the pleasures of being able to succeed at something worthwhile.
Right, thank you.
so much.
I'd like to start this session by asking a question to both speakers. And that is, I think it is universally agreed that even in hypnosis, people cannot be made to act against their own moral, their own morality. In a case, as you were describing earlier, where people will go and murder in somnambulism or automatism, or no, not automatism, but during sleep or whatever, or commit any other crime of that type of nature, does the moral profile of the person ever, is that ever considered by the courts and by the experts, the moral profile?
Can I jump in straight away? Because quite often when one has the sleepwalking defence, the person is of good character. In fact, in many ways, it's one of the characteristics one checks in one's list of things of, well, are they just lying about the whole event? Mm-hmm. And so I'd say yes. I mean, I think the interesting thing with the meeting as a whole, because I was thinking about motivation, unconscious motivation, conscious motivation, and I was going back to why, with some of these individuals, do they react the way they do? But they're often of good character, unblemished. And very often the murders, the assaults, are hugely ferocious. So when I was going through some of the neurobiology, what I'd flag is that the centres that inhibit a rage attack don't seem to be operating at that point. Where it starts to get more and more difficult is how one gets that person to the act. I mean, so sleepwalkers do walk, but say another characteristic where one's comfortable that it might be an automatistic attack is where they're of good character, and by chance the victim has ended up with them, and then you get this ferocious attack. It starts to get more complicated. I know I had a complicated case up there where one has somebody of good character, but it's quite a complex behaviour to get to the point where the attack has happened. But yes, in the first instance, one would asks that question. Yeah.
What about from the moral profile is a very broad phrase, and I think I would want to unpick what exactly it meant before deciding how far I thought that a jury ought to take a generalized view of the defendant's moral profile into account in deciding whether they did what they're accused of doing, whether it was voluntary, and whether they had the necessary intent. Let me just give a couple of reasons why I think that moral profile as perceived by a jury, if allowed as an unrestrained idea, could work against the interests of justice. It's more easy to identify these cases when you're not looking at your own society, your own time. Take the case of Ruth Ellis, who was, I believe, the last woman hanged for murder. It was widely thought that she was convicted by the jury and sentenced to death because they took very much against her lifestyle in the 1950s, and that had she presented with a somewhat different profile, but the facts had been exactly the same, she wouldn't have been convicted. But this woman living her loose life and behaving the way she did had absolutely no jury sympathy, and there I suspect their view of her moral profile in ways which weren't truly relevant to the issues the jury have to decide were certainly thought at the time to tell against her. Take another example. I'm going tomorrow to the States, and I'm going to be very privileged on Monday to have dinner with a man who's now, I think, 89, and who in the 1960s had a very high position in the US Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, dealing with legal issues concerning the civil rights movement of the 1960s. In particular, he was involved in the prosecution under federal law of a number of people who were responsible for carrying out the most horrific murder of three young civil rights workers in 1963. The civil rights workers traveled down to Mississippi in order to try and assist blacks to register for voting. And the local Ku Klux Klan, in conspiracy with the sheriff and the deputy sheriff, arranged for these people to be picked up, arrested for speeding, taken into prison and kept in custody for long enough for the Ku Klux Klan to be able to plan their murder. So a pit was dug for the bodies to be put, and after 6 hours they were released on bail, and the sheriff escorted them to the county boundary and let them go, where they were immediately abducted by the KKK, murdered, put in the pre-dug burial site, and 150 tons of soil was put on top. They weren't prosecuted for murder, because murder in the United States is a state offence, not a federal offence, and the state authorities in Mississippi would never have dreamt of prosecuting in those circumstances. At that time, no white man had ever been convicted before a Missouri jury of the murder of a black man or a civil rights worker in anything resembling those circumstances. The gentleman who I'm going to be having dinner with was instrumental in bringing them to trial in federal court for an offence of conspiring to deprive the civil rights workers of their rights under the Constitution, which was a roundabout way of trying to secure some sort of justice. And it was widely predicted that no Mississippi jury would ever convict. It was a landmark case because this Mississippi jury did in fact convict a number of the defendants. But why do I say all that? Because in the culture of that time, the many people in Mississippi, and probably the average jury, would have regarded what the defendants did as morally right. They regarded them as having a good moral profile. The fact they had committed murder in law shouldn't result in their conviction. So I think letting juries take broad concepts of moral profile into account in deciding whether guilt is proven of a particular case causes me unease.
Thank you. That's a very comprehensive answer. Okay, we'll open it up now. Please try and catch the eyes of the people who've got the microphones. And I would also like to ask you, will you say your name and also your profession or the field from which you're coming, and whether you're directing your question to one or the other of the speakers or both? Thank you.
My name's Sun Tui. I'm working as a psychotherapist, particularly with horses, to help in that work. And one of my main areas of interest is working with soldiers and their families, or servicemen and their families, with the issues around pre-deployment, deployments, and coming home post-deployment. So I work with families and I'm looking to investigate that. One of the things that is a big issue that's coming up now is we're seeing a lot of servicemen ending up in prison. Really, really high numbers. And it seems to be correlating with the fact that there's a level of undiagnosed post-traumatic stress. So I think both of you could offer some advice and some opinions. We would like to look at how we could best go forward in evidencing some of this to try and give more, you know, if the money is being spent in convictions and putting in and housing them in prison, could we not do more about supporting that before it gets in the first place? Thank you.
I'll pick it up in a couple of different ways, and it's sort of practical. Some of the work I do is with Headley Court, so that's the rehab end. And we've had a couple of different questions have arisen, and part of it actually draws to the sort of lucid dreaming, post-traumatic stress disorder. How can we handle that? There's also the element of we're looking at, because if somebody's involved in a traumatic event and they're asleep within 6 to 12 hours later, there's a higher incidence of recurrent nightmares, daytime intrusions, and the question arises whether one can actually reduce the incidence of post-traumatic stress disorder, or at least that component of it, on with how you deal with it in combat or at the zone. And one of the things that's happening at the moment, it depends on their injuries, is that they could be sedated. And again, it's a question mark. So we've got a research question mark sitting there on how do you deal with them at the beginning to prevent the development of post-traumatic stress disorder. Then the other side is what I started to allude to this morning, that how can you actually manage the symptoms once it's developed?
I'm not qualified to say whether I think that this is a consequence of PTSD. That's Chris's field. I do know that it is a matter of real concern, the number of ex-servicemen we now have in prison. I don't have the figures at my fingertips. I suspect, but I can't put it any higher than this, the problem may be a little broader than whether there is an actual clinical diagnosis available of PTSD. If you just think of the lifestyle that people have been leading in the army and then what they come back to on release, they've been operating in conditions which may be boring for quite a bit of the time but extremely frightening at others. And when the adrenaline is rushing, when they have got the support of their colleagues, and they are separated from their family for quite a period of time. They then come back, and life takes on a slightly different shape. It's going out with wife or partner to the shop and doing the shopping, and maybe there's a bawling child, and you know, there's nappies and so on. And it's actually not quite the same thing. And I think some find this really quite difficult to adjust to. That's putting it in a very general and unprofessional way. In answer to your question, what do we think can be done? Can I do a plug here, unashamedly? I suggest you go onto the website and look up Time for Families, a charity my wife happens to be closely involved with, which works with prisoners and their partners, and I've actually seen in operation. What it does is over a course of lectures, it gets the partner into prison, and they talk through in a group a number of issues about relationships. One, for example, is about money matters, which can often be a cause of friction, and I've seen this happen. Each of them are given a pack of cards, and on those are all sorts of things which they might spend money on. And they're asked to, firstly, individually, sort those out. They're told that they can have 12 which go into the must-have category, and then you know, 6 which can go into the would-like-to category, and the rest have got to be irrelevant. And then, once they've each done that individually, they're asked to then get together and see if they can agree a list. You know, and how important is this against that? And they actually get discussing it. And in many cases of these people, it's the first time that they've ever actually done this sort of exercise. Now, I think that there would be a real case for expanding that sort of program to all sorts of other people. And I think that as part of reintegration of servicemen in from that sort of background, running courses of that kind could be really helpful. There's much more to the course, which I'd love to talk to you about over lunch, but there are plenty of other questions.
Can I just throw in a bit more? First, it's a reflection, and then it goes back to a question. When one's looking across conflicts, there's been this increase in post-traumatic stress disorder. I think in the US, a particularly large increase in post-traumatic stress disorder, but there is, which doesn't seem to occur in the UK. Although there's an increase. And in the US, the question mark is, because if you end up with a diagnosable disorder, you remain within the Veterans Administration system and you're looked after. And the PTSD actually appears to come quite late, just at the point where if they haven't developed a disorder, then they wouldn't be able to get support. But the question was, I realise I don't know what they're being convicted for here. Although there's an increase, I don't actually know what the convictions, you know, whether...
GBH mostly.
Yeah, I think... Yeah. I think the question also applies to the fact that the people who come back from these war zones have witnessed horrendous episodes, which then create the PTSD. Anyway, I think what we'll need to do is to keep our questions a bit shorter and our answers a bit shorter as well, because there are lots of people on this side who would like to...
I was intrigued recently by the story of the woman who tickled a cat's neck and then put it in a bin and closed the lid. And there was a video on the internet, and I don't know if any of the panellists have seen it. But what struck me as very odd was she was almost seemed to be in a sleepwalking kind of state. I mean, she didn't seem to be sort of, you know, energetically involved in her actions. And she said that she didn't know why she'd done it, and it caused outcry, as you may know, in the news. She didn't know why she'd put the cat in the bin, since she seemed to like it beforehand. So does anyone have any kind of explanation for that? Is it possible to be sleepwalking while awake, I suppose, is what I'm asking.
The short answer is no. I actually can't guide you, although it does remind me of something completely different. It's what were called the inverted flowerpot experiments in the 60s and 70s, when one was looking at the how rapid eye movement sleep impacted on behaviour. The way it was done was you'd have a pool of water and an inverted flowerpot, and you'd sit the cat on top of the flowerpot, and whenever it went into rapid eye movement sleep, the muscles would be paralysed and it'd fall into the water, and you'd prevent it from getting into REM. I don't think we're allowed to do that anymore.
I have a question for Lord Justice Toulson. I wonder if you... my name is Michael Heap, and I'm a clinical and forensic psychologist. Can you clarify duress for me? I'm thinking of the kind that a young person... doesn't have a mental illness or anything, but is rather vulnerable, maybe learning difficulties, who says, I was forced to go along with this by my co-accused because he said otherwise he'd beat me up. Yeah. And I wonder how strong a defence that is.
Yes. I'm grateful to you for raising the question. I was going to deal with that, but left it up on account of time, but this gives me the opportunity to answer it. Duress is available to all offences other than a homicide. It's not available as a defence to murder. And the essence of duress is that the defendant must have acted under a threat of death or serious injury to himself or somebody else, e.g. family member, of a kind that was sufficiently immediate that he couldn't take any kind of alternative action to protect them, e.g. by going to the police, and a reasonable person in the same circumstances would have acted in the same way. Once raised by the defence, it's for the prosecution to disprove. So that in summary, is the law in that area.
This question for Justice Toulson. How do you think it will work with the proposed changes to first degree and second degree murder with the defence of diminished, and how will that pan out?
How long have you got? I was heavily involved in the writing of a report which recommended that we introduce first and second degree murder, and it was very widely supported across the range of people who we consulted at the time. Obviously, not everybody agreed. It's a high political subject, but it did carry a wide measure of support. I think that it would actually work really very sensibly for those who don't know about the degrees. We thought that this current cut-off between murder and manslaughter, is which was developed by judges 100 years ago, isn't very satisfactory. It's full of anomalies at the moment, and we thought that you should keep the top tier for cases where the person actually intended to kill or intended to cause serious injury with the real recognition of the possible fatal results, and that there should then be a second category of people who broadly carried out attacks on people with recognition that you could cause serious injury but not contemplating death, and without the same level of intent. That's a broad summary. It would also it would cover a category of reckless person who goes out in an armed gang, not with the intention, but not too careful about what the consequence might be. And then that would actually cover rather more people than at the moment are liable for murder. Manslaughter would be cases of people who intend some injury, but not necessarily serious injury, the classic one-punch manslaughter. And the result of this would be that some people would get second-degree murder who at the moment would get manslaughter. Some people would also get second-degree murder who at the moment get murder with a mandatory life sentence. We thought it was a more sensible division. At the moment, it doesn't look as though there's any political likelihood of it being introduced. I'll happily talk to you about more of the details over lunch.
Stan Gerrard from Aberdeen. I'm a professional hypnotherapist and get involved in some forensic hypnosis situations. And my question is regarding forensic hypnosis. What is the current position in law, preferably including Scots law, for use of hypnosis with victims or witnesses or possibly even the accused in cases to establish an additional line of inquiry, like before it's come to court, which might result in an additional source of information which would otherwise not have been available had it not been investigated? What would be the position in law in court where the witness has come up with information which has subsequently been corroborated but before presentation to court?
I'm not aware that this has actually arisen, so I'm flying by my seat of my pants in asking what would be the position. I infer that the situation we're imagining is that under hypnosis the witness has come up with matters which they weren't previously able to come up with. Right. Well, I think the position would be this. The witness would make a further witness statement saying, further to my original statement, I am now able to recall as follows. And I now say that is my memory, the process by which that memory was developed was that I had this hypnosis. The jury would then have to decide whether the witness's present claimed memory is an accurate and reliable memory, and might hear expert evidence on both sides on that subject.
Whether it was corroborated or not, what you suggest is it has not yet been corroborated.
Yes, I mean, I don't think, technically, I don't think a witness can corroborate himself or herself. Oh, yes. Well, obviously, I mean, it's always very helpful to a prosecution's case if they've got other evidence that independently undergirds the evidence that the witness is giving. There have, I think, been cases where people have said that they've had reclaimed memory as a result of psychotherapy.
Right.
And then questions have been raised as to the reliability of that. So the situation you're contemplating is not totally different from that.
David Cantor, forensic psychologist. I just wonder how you view the possibility of defences in relation to other aspects of personality. This has come up in cases I've been asked to comment on, where the individual doesn't have any sort of psychiatrically identifiable problem, but you may say that because of the need for others and for support, and that they are perhaps more vulnerable to duress. And in my experience, it was very limited experience, the courts have been very reluctant to accept that there is a possibility of identifying personality characteristics that makes the person more likely to find the way into a criminal context. And I think it relates to the general issues that we're talking about today. But I just wonder, it's not often one has the opportunity to quiz a top judge. Can I just say, I once said to a journalist on The Sun, why do you always say your experts are the top experts? And she said, without batting an eyelid, because leading has too many letters in it.
I'm not surprised that the attempt met with strong discouragement from the court. It can't provide a defence for somebody to say, well, you know, I'm peculiarly likely to do this sort of thing because I'm afraid those are the influences in my life. And we fear that it's true, but that doesn't reduce legal responsibility. As to the specific example of duress, there is an objective test to be applied here. That is, would a reasonable person have acted in the way that this person did? And for the defendant to say, well, I was particularly under the influence of this person, wouldn't water down the fact that the court would still say to the jury, you've got to decide whether a reasonable person would have done. Otherwise, it's a very ready defence for criminal gangs that somebody says, well, you know, I happen to belong to this criminal gang, and when the boss says you jump, you say how high, and because I've known what he's done to other people, I felt under duress to do it. A reasonable person would not have put himself in that situation, and he wouldn't get over that part of the test.
Trying to explore how one assesses reasonableness of a person within the context of, say, an individual being a very needy person, somebody who, unlike other members of the gang, he, because of his upbringing and his circumstances, he was very prone to be influenced by others.
The short answer is it is a question for the jury, and there is, I recognise, a line to be drawn, which is very difficult to identify intellectually. The jury has to draw pragmatic, use its sense in this way. Clearly, if the defendant is a woman living in a relationship with an abusive man, in circumstances where she can't get out of it, and this is what he's ordering her to do, her circumstances are very different from the same woman being told the same thing by a free male friend in a pub. So the relationship between the person who's being coerced and the coercer is obviously a relevant matter. That said and done, I don't think that the defendant can say, well, aside from my particular relationship, I am a more suggestible person than others, so judge me by a different test from anybody else.
Yes, I think I have some experience that may be relevant to the gentleman at the front who asked about hypnosis and forensic interviewing. I've been involved in two cases. The first was a case in Maidstone Crown Court in the late 80s, which came out just after the Home Office guidelines were released. Now, the Home Office guidelines suggest that you don't actually use hypnosis because of the problem of pseudo-memories. And following the American model, we don't actually have the per se exclusion rule that they do in many states, and most states in America now. But the guidelines do suggest that you don't use it, except in serious cases, which is interesting. And that was on the advice of the Association of Chief Police Officers. Anyway, the first case that I'm aware of was one I was involved in, the Maidstone Crown Court, where they had a trial within a trial to see whether the witnesses who had been hypnotized would be able to give evidence. And in fact, it was thrown out. So the trial didn't go ahead. They decided, based on the American model, that they wouldn't allow this to go ahead. The other bizarre case was what I said bizarre was in the mid-90s. It's the Browning case. Now, Browning was convicted of murdering Marie Wilkes by the M50. And he was tried and convicted. Then afterwards, it emerged from a conversation at a conference that he'd been that the chief witness for the prosecution, an Inspector Clark, had been hypnotized to help him remember better. Unfortunately, what he remembered under hypnosis contradicted his original testimony, and wasn't as good as his original testimony. So they conveniently forgot to mention to the court that he'd been hypnotized. This came up at appeal, and in fact, Browning was let off. Browning was it was reversed on appeal. I had to give evidence in that case because what the police then tried to do when they wanted was to dismiss the evidence of their own witness who they'd hypnotized. In other words, what they then wanted to say, well, we want to get rid of this now, so we want to say that the evidence he's come up with is actually misleading because of the American experience, etc. And my testimony was that you take it on a case-by-case basis. Anyway, the appeal was successful. So my advice when police officers ring me up is if someone's suggesting use hypnosis, it potentially could have benefits, but legally, get your barge pole out, because if someone, a smart lawyer in court working on the American model, could make mincemeat of it, you're better off with the cognitive interview, which also may have problems, but at the moment, the courts seem to be more favorably disposed to it. Anyway, that's my answer.
That's Professor Graham Wagstaff, who is a speaker this afternoon. Thank you. Okay, I think we'll have one more question. Last one.
Okay. Johnny Lyons, my name. I'm a retired surgeon. I'm just wondering where morality comes into the law. You're not assessing the moral state of the criminal, and it seems to me it's far more a pragmatic social thing. And when you're bringing in all these different reasons why people behave in certain ways, there are, to my mind, another million that go to make up how we behave, which are just as relevant in terms of excusing our behavior if that's what you want to do. So does morality have any real application in the underpinning of the law or not?
I think that our sense of fairness does play an important part in the way in which the rules have been shaped. I mean, to take the extreme example, to find that I am guilty of unlawfully wounding somebody in the pub because my elbow holding a drink got jerked into her face would be, in most people's estimation, profoundly unfair. And there is therefore, at a very broad level of generality, a desire to shape rules of criminal law in a way which are accord with our own sense of moral values. But everybody will agree with the proposition that the law ought to be fair and just. The disagreement is likely to come when you apply that to particular questions. And I quite agree that
there, you're not going to find some theoretical high-level morality which provides the answer to that question. Nevertheless, I think the way in which the courts shape the law will be influenced by their own broad sense of what is morally just and right, which will be a reflection of the society in which they live.
Okay. I think I'd like to ask you one last question, and that is, I fortuitously was called to do jury service earlier this year, which was a huge coincidence because this conference had already been planned, and it was an amazing experience, very interesting. How would you as a judge direct the jury when it comes to this kind of very subtle question of intentionality or intention, volition, as you call it, in cases where this is not a clear-cut situation?
Well, I would try not to give them the sort of law lecture that you've had to suffer from this morning. I would try to state the principles as shortly as I could, attuned to the facts of the case, so that I would say, look, this is the case as the prosecution presents it, this is the case as the defence presents it, the prosecution has got to prove the following, and then, and I would say, law is for me, the facts are for you, in relation to whether the defendant's act was volitional, I would frame my directions rather as I did this morning. I'd say, look, was this something he could do anything about? Was this some supervenient vector over which he had no control? Was this something which he should have anticipated? If it was some supervenient event over which he had no control and he shouldn't have anticipated, then it's not his act, he's not guilty. If you're satisfied that the prosecution have got over that hurdle, well then, the intent that has to be proved for this offence is the following. Here's the evidence. Are you persuaded that he or she in fact had that intent? I try to keep it simple.
Right, interesting. Because we were very firmly directed that we could only that we all could only convict if we were 100% certain of our view. If we had the slightest bit of doubt, we should not convict. But anyway, most of the questions were directed to Roger, which is fair enough because Roger is not going to be here with us later on, whereas Chris is. So all the questions that have been brewing for Chris can be addressed at our plenary session between 4 and 5 o'clock. Thank you very much. Thank you very much to both speakers. Let's show them our appreciation.